My guest is Jim Lehrer. He's the co-anchor and associate editor of the McNeil Lehrer NewsHour on public television. It's the only national early evening TV news broadcast that's an hour long and that regularly features live interviews and lengthy, in-depth reports. Jim Lehrer and Robert McNeil have been partners for 13 years, but in 1983, a heart attack and double bypass surgery forced Lehrer to take a long break from work. When he recovered, he not only resumed his television career, he also resumed writing fiction, something he had abandoned in the 1960s after the publication of his novel Viva Max. Since his heart attack, Lehrer has written several plays, including Chili Queen, which was produced in New York and Washington. His new novel, Kick the Can, has just been published. It's set in America's Midwest and South. These are territories Lehrer knows well. He grew up in Kansas and spent most of the 1960s working for Texas newspapers as a reporter, political columnist, and city editor. I asked Jim Lehrer why writing fiction is so important to him now.
Well, it's always been important to me. At least it's always, since I was about 18 years old, been important to me. And then I got very much in, there were three things in my life, my early 20s and 30s, that were important to me. My family, I am married and have three daughters. My work, which was journalism, newspaper work, then television work. And the third was my fiction writing. I found, after a while, I wrote a novel and then I wrote another book. Anyhow, after a while, I found that I could not do all three of them well. I was still writing, but what I was writing was not very good. And so anyhow, I decided I had to get rid of one of the three. I decided to keep my family. I had no choice on the job, so I just put my writing aside. Then I had a heart attack. That was 4 years ago, over 4 years ago now. And while I was recuperating, I wouldn't say, I don't want to overdo this or overdramatize it, but the fact is I really did lie there and worry and concern myself with what I wanted to do with myself, assuming that I got out of it okay, and I went through all my priorities. I went through my life. How did I like my life? What did I, you know, and the fact is I liked me. You know, I liked what I was doing. I liked my priorities, and I thought I was doing fine. But there was a huge gap, and I realized I had to get back to my fiction writing. It was so much a drive in me for reasons that I can't explain that. It was just there.
But, you know, it's interesting. After a heart attack, I think people usually try to cut down on stress and simplify their lives a little bit, and you added this whole new dimension to it. What did you give up in your life in order to make room for your writing?
Well, what I discovered, Terry, was that I had a lot more energy and a lot more physical energy as well as mental energy than I realized that I had. And as a result of the heart attack, I also then had a bypass operation, which for some reason rejuvenated me in some ways. As I've often said, McNeil, my partner Robert McNeil, said the blood finally started getting to my brain, which helped a little bit. The other thing is, I started taking a nap every day. I mean, that was the doctor said, take a nap every day when you go back to work. And so I did, and I still do. I mean, I'm not doing it now for heart attack reasons. I'm doing it for lifestyle reasons. I now have divided my day into 2 days. So you have 1 day, I have 2 days. You have 7 days, I have 14 days. I go to work I get up early in the morning, I write, I go to work, I take a nap from 1 to 2 o'clock. I don't sleep the whole time, but I take a nap. Then I get up 2 o'clock, and it's all pressure and all that sort of highfalutin stuff to do the news hour in the evening. Then I'm home at 8 o'clock and I'm refreshed. I mean, it's midday for me for my second day, and I'm able to write. The other thing I realized is that when something truly is important to you, you can find time to do it, and I have found the other side of it is, and it's also part and parcel, a big part and parcel of your question. Why would I add another anxiety? I mean, an anxiety. Are people going to like my plays? You know, are the critics going to close my plays? Are the critics going to like my book? Is anybody going to buy my book? I agree with that. I don't know why I did that. The only problem with that is that's the only way, if you're going to write, you got to expose yourself. I do not enjoy that. I'm used to exposing myself on television. The exposure that goes with putting out a play or putting out a book and letting people shoot at it, that is not a pleasant experience. And I wish I could do it all in private, but I can't.
Yeah. Jim Lehrer is my guest. You know, most of us have heard you read the news and interview people on your program and report, but we haven't heard you read from your own novel, so let me ask you to give that a shot now. Maybe you could read the opening paragraph of your new novel, Kick the Can.
I'd love to, Terry. The first chapter is entitled, To Be a Pirate, and it begins this way. I was too old to play Kick the Can anymore, so I was just standing there watching when Jimmy T came running in from behind our house. He kicked the can as hard as he could. It flew up toward me, and the ragged part of the lid caught my left eye. It tore it halfway out of the socket. There was a lot of bleeding and crying, and when it was all over at St. Joseph's Hospital, I had lost my left eye forever.
You know, later what happens in the novel is that this young man, because he's lost his eye, gives up his plans to follow in his father's footsteps and become a state trooper. And he becomes temporarily a bus pirate. He kind of kidnaps this bus with an outlaw friend of his. Now, a lot of people know one thing about you, which is that you are really obsessed with buses.
Obsessed. I'm not, I think.
Not obsessed.
Interested.
Interested. It's,
right.
It's, now, you're, and your family owned a small bus company back,
that's right.
Back when, in the 40s, was it?
In the 40s, yeah. For 1 year, 46 to 47, in Kansas.
So you've managed to work buses into your new novel, and I guess they've been an interesting part of your life. Did you ever harbor this fantasy of driving a bus yourself?
Oh, yeah.
Did you get to do it?
Well, when I was in college, I went to a little junior college the first 2 years in South Texas. I worked as a ticket agent at the Trailways Bus Depot at night. And I never drove a bus, except, you know, around the parking lot and all of that. But, no, that's what I wanted. When I was a kid, that's what I wanted to be. And in my garage, we lived in Kansas, Wichita, Kansas at the time. And I set up, used an apple crate lid as a steering wheel, and I set up chairs behind me. And I had a hat and a ticket punch. And I'm not talking yesterday. I mean, you know, when I was 10, 11 years old, 9, 10, 11 years old, and I drove everywhere in this country with my passengers behind me. I saw bus drivers as very heroic people, much like you would see a ship captain or used to see airline captains before deregulation. At any rate, it was always one of my dreams, and to be a bus driver. And it's been a part of me. My dad was in the bus business when I was born, and he was still in it when he died. So it's always been a part of my life.
Did you do bus announcements?
Yes, at the bus depot in Victoria. I called the buses, and that was my favorite thing to do. In fact, that was the first time I actually spoke into a microphone publicly. It was calling the bus in Victoria.
Could you do a little bit of that for
sure,
us?
Sure. May I have your attention, please? This is your first call for Continental Trailways, 8:10 a.m., Silverside's Thruliner to Houston and Dallas. Now leaving from Lane 1 for Inez, Edna, Ganado, Louise, El Campo, Pierce, Wharton, Hungerford, Kendleton, Beasley, Rosenberg, Richmond, Sugarland, Stafford, Missouri City, and Houston. Connecting in Houston for Huntsville, Buffalo, Corsicana, Dallas-Fort Worth, Wichita Falls, Amarillo, Tucumcari, Flagstaff, and Los Angeles. All aboard, please. Your first call, Continental Trailways, 8:10 a.m., Silverside's Thruliner to Houston and Dallas, now leaving from Lane 1 next to the building. Don't forget your baggage, please.
Oh, that's very convincing.
See that? Do you know the old story?
You changed your voice for that, by the way.
Yeah, I know. You know the old story that if you ever memorized a speech from Shakespeare in high school, it never leaves you?
Right.
Unfortunately, I didn't memorize Shakespeare. I just memorized this bus call. But it's part of me.
Has writing for broadcast, writing news for broadcast, and writing intros to discussions and things like that affected the way you write fiction now? Do the simple, lean sentences for broadcasting translate to fiction?
Yes, I think they do. Unconsciously, I think they do. The other thing, I think writing for the ear rather than writing for the eye is a very helpful exercise because you must have rhythm. And there is rhythm in narrative. And I think it's helped me tremendously. Also, you tend to think more in terms of beginning, middles, and endings when you're writing for the year. You know, George Shultz arrived today in Geneva. He did this and this and this. Now, that's, you know, that's no big deal. But you know that if a story, if you start a story, you got to end it. And the same thing applies when you're writing fiction. I think it's helped me. I really do.
Jim Lehrer is my guest. He's the co-anchor of the McNeil Lehrer NewsHour on public television. He's also written a new novel titled Kick the Can. You know, you have been the subject of many interviews since your heart attack, really, in 1983, and then since the writing of your plays and your new novel. Have you learned a lot about interviewing from being an interviewee yourself?
I have, I think. McNeil says, I think correctly, that I am a terrible, you just found out, in fact, that I am a terrible interviewee. Because I give very long answers. In fact, he said, you know, Larry, if you were ever on our program, we'd never invite you back because your answers are free. You asked me a question when we started. You know, I went on for 5 minutes, I think. I mean, that's a problem I have. And I understand. I've sympathized. And I'm sure you must, too. I mean, I have great sympathy for the people I'm interviewing because I ask a question of somebody. Now, keep in mind, 99% of the interviews I do are live. I ask somebody a question. And then I'm immediately jumping, ready to, I'm ready for the next question or ready to go on with it, you know. And it must be terrible to be interviewed by me in some ways. I'm sure it is. I mean, I would much rather interview than be interviewed. I have learned a lot just because out of sympathy for the people as a result of being the subject of the interview. There's no question about it. I now understand how difficult it is.
Well, do you tell the people who are appearing on your program to give you short answers? and how do you stop them if the answers are long?
What I tell the folks to do is to give their best answer. If it's short, that's fine. If it's long, that's fine. I can always interrupt them. I interrupt people for a living is what I tell them. It's very important that the person not have to confine themselves to your rules. If somebody speaks... for instance, if let's say somebody is like me, gives long answers like I'm giving you right now, as a matter of fact. But I mean, that's your problem. See, that's not my problem.
I mean,
if you ask me the story of my life, and if it takes 2 hours to tell you the story of my life, I think it takes 2 hours, and it's your job as the professional to tone it, to cut it down a little bit. And I think that also you get better answers that way. If I say to somebody, sits down, is already nervous. Now, that's not true if people are used to television, but if somebody comes in, they're very nervous. A live show, going all over the country, their mother's watching, and everybody's there. And I say to them, all right, keep your answer short and blah, blah, blah. All it does is add to their anxiety. And I want to make people, I want people to be relaxed. I want them to forget that there are all these lights and cameras around and do their, and have eye contact. We sit, our studios are set up, both in Washington and New York, are set up.
This answer's too long. No, yeah, I'm kidding. All right.
I know it is.
So I try that out, right. See what happens.
See, it doesn't work with me. That's McNeil's right. But we set our people, our guests are very close to us, and there's direct eyeball-to-eyeball contact. So you try to confine the situation so the person is comfortable, and all they have to do is look at you. They don't have to look around. There's not a place to be distracted, and it's to make people comfortable. You got any more questions that I can just rattle on and on about?
We're just going to have to wrap up now.
Okay.
I mean, you've just gone on too long. No, I'm kidding. You've had to interview many politicians over the years, and I think that is always so difficult because politicians give you answers, but they're not necessarily answers to the questions you've asked. I don't mean you in particular, but in general. What are some of the techniques you've come up with for actually getting an answer to the question that you want answered? Because you're just not necessarily going to get it.
Terry, there's only one technique that works, and that's to have enough time to ask the question a second time. And then a third time,
mm-hmm.
and maybe a fourth time. And
mm-hmm.
then if Billy Bob, Senator, isn't going to answer it, you at least have a stab. That's his option, you see. If he doesn't want to, there's no law that says he has to answer all the questions that Jimmy Charles Lehrer asks him on television. But I have the time. We have the time on our program. So, Senator, what is your position on selling grain to the Soviet Union? Well, you know, Jim, that reminds me of when I was a little boy growing up in Oklahoma, and he tells you a story. And I answer, yeah, but Senator, you give him the time, he does that, and you say, yes, but what's your position on selling grain? Well, you, first of all, you got to understand what grain is. Grains are these little, he still hasn't that. So then you say, yes, but Senator, again, you know, and then finally you have to decide, and you're sitting there in a live situation, do I ask this sucker this question again, or do I go on? You have to, at some point, you have to have real confidence in your audience that they realize, hey, this jerk isn't going to answer this question, or this wonderful man isn't going to answer this question, or whatever the situation is, then you go on with it. And I do not believe in beating up on guests, or I don't. We don't invite people on our program to abuse them. And so the other way to do it, if you don't have the time, is you say, you didn't answer my question, you know? Hey, blah, blah, blah. You know, we don't do it that way. And cause it's not because we object to it. That's somebody else's job to object to it. That's just not our style. We're not comfortable doing that. And we have the luxury of time.
Jim Lehrer is my guest, and he's the co-anchor of the McNeil Lehrer NewsHour on public television. He's also a novelist and playwright, and his new novel is titled Kick the Can. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Jim Lehrer is my guest. You know, you strike me as one of the few news anchors on television, I mean, you and McNeil, really, who do more than just read the news while the newscast is on. Does the emphasis that American news viewers put on news anchors on commercial news seem a little absurd to you?
It seems incredibly absurd to me. I don't understand it. I simply do not understand the value that is placed on the ability of somebody to look into a television camera and read a teleprompter. Now, that's called a short answer.
Right. but would you ever want to be in a situation like that? What I'm thinking is that your partner, Robert McNeil, went back and forth during his career between commercial and public television. To my knowledge, the only television work you've done is on public television.
That's right. I went right from the newspapers. I went right from newspapers to public television. Look, my feeling about that is always, it's always been consistent, I must say. The one thing I've been consistent on is that if commercial television or any other kind of television or a bus company or anybody else came along and offered me a job that was better than the one I have, I would seriously consider it. And if it was really better, I'd probably take it. Now, better in any way you want to define better. I have had opportunities to go into commercial television, but none of them involved anything that was anywhere near, I have the best job in television journalism. And it happens to be on public television. I mean, it could be somewhere else. But what I do now, in the atmosphere in which I do it, with the people with whom I do it, and particularly Robert McNeil, who is one of the really nice people in this whole world. He's my best friend, in addition to being my partner, business-wise and journalistic-wise, and whatever. You talk about my heart attack. We're talking about my heart attack. He got me through that. I mean, he really did. Anyhow, if somebody were to come along tomorrow and offer me something that's better than what I'm doing, I would do it. I think it's impossible because I cannot conceive of a better job than the one I have. They'd have to create it. It doesn't exist now, let's put it that way.
You know, you and McNeil, from what I understand, basically own the newscast, you and Gannett.
Well, not Gannett. Gannett is no longer, we're no longer.
Oh, you're
at
like
one
with
time,
okay.
We had a relationship with Gannett. Our company, McNeil Lehrer Productions, produces it in conjunction with WNET and WETA, the public television station in Washington, New York. We own it together.
So did you want more independence? Is that why you're a co-owner of it now?
That's right. That's right.
Were there ways that you felt that you were getting, that there were too many cooks making this broth with input from all the stations?
Well, it's not that. Journalism, whether it's on television, here I'm going to give you, journalism, whether it's on television or wherever it is, it's hard always to get it right, and that's really what it's all about. Anytime you introduce any outside, in the best situation, it's hard to get it right. You're going to make mistakes. You're going to just decide, make decisions that are wrong. You make hundreds of decisions in any given day in journalism, in a daily journalism operation. Anytime you introduce any outside factor, like, oh, the publisher doesn't like cats, so we can't do a cat story, even though the governor has just run over one with a pickup truck, you see. Oh, well, that we can't do that. Oh, well, the station owners wife is involved in such and such a charity. Well, we have to cover that. Or, you know, any time you start introducing, or this public television station in Topeka does not like stories about, you know, left-handed baseball pitchers who are now running for Congress in North Carolina, whatever. Anytime you introduce those kinds of things into the decision, you increase the chances of making mistakes and getting it wrong. So independence is not independence is the independence to be wrong. In other words, if you don't have the right to be wrong and to call your own shots in journalism, you won't be right very often because you'll be so uptight all the time. Oh, you're going to offend somebody. Oh, you're not going to, you know, you got to please these people and please that people. And the reason we wanted our independence was to be able to try to get it right as we possibly could. And that's what we have. We have the ideal situation. But I would ask you, because a lot of people in print say, hey, isn't that a right? You know, McNeil and Lehrer own their own program. Isn't that outrageous? Is that any more outrageous than the Sulzbergers owning the New York Times? Somebody, you know, what's the deal? We're journalists. What's wrong with journalists running their own operation, you mm-hmm. know, and that's really all it's about. And we'll rise and fall on our journalism. And I'm very comfortable with that.
You know, as we talk, I'm hearing more of a Southern accent from you than I think I hear on the program.
Yes, I think so. Here's the reason for that is that on television, particularly stuff to camera, I'm trying very carefully to pronounce the words fully.
Mm-hmm.
You know, good evening. The new, you know, tonight, whatever. And when you get in a conversation, when I get into a conversational thing, the words tend to, I turned around and I tend to go back to the way I used to talk. It's not a conscious thing. I didn't consciously say, I gotta quit talking like a hillbilly or anything like that, because I don't talk like a hillbilly. But it's just conversationally, I do tend to talk a little differently.
You've taken today off from doing the program, from doing the McNeil Era NewsHour.
Right.
When you do that, when you take a day away, which I'm sure is pretty pretty rare, do you hope that it's going to be a slow news day, or do you hope that it's going to be a big news day? I mean, would you feel really bad if you missed a big event? Or
I used to. I don't anymore. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is, I'll tell you a story about that if you've got a lot of time. No.
I was in
Jackson, Mississippi, working on a play where the United States bombed Libya. And I called McNeil that morning early, and I said, Robin, what do I do? Do I stay here? I was working on a play with Eudora Welty.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, I can get on a plane and I can fly back and do the program. And he says, my friend, he says, well, now let's think about that. How many people are there in this world who can come on television and talk about the impact, et cetera, of Libya being bombed? And I said, oh, 3,000, 4,000 probably, maybe more. He said, how many people can spend the day with Eudora Welty working on his play? I said, I'll see you later. I mean, that was it, you know, and I stayed there. And the other reason, of course, is we have tremendous people. Judy Woodruff and Charlene Hunter Gault fill in when either one of us is gone. They're as capable as I am. And, you know, there's a network atmosphere. Oh, my goodness. I mean, these people, you know, drop everything when there's a major story. We do not do that. Neither Robin nor I do that. There's an inclination, just because we're still hearing the fire engines, to want to do it. But it's a practical matter. The news hour can get along without me, no matter how big the story is.
Is that something that your heart attack taught you also, that you could be
you
away
bet.
From the program for a while and you'd survive and it would survive and you could go back and pick up?
You bet. No question about it.
How do you deal with all the adrenaline of the day as the news day builds and as you're getting ready for your deadline? After a kind of health problem, a health crisis like you had, you try to, like, keep calm. And I think there's no way of keeping calm when you're working with the news, especially in a live broadcast.
Well, there's stages during the day. I'm very much I've been dealing with daily deadlines for 27 years. So the clock is part of, you know, at a certain time. You can't suddenly look out at 6 o'clock Eastern time and say, sorry, folks, we're not quite ready. You just, you know, just stay where you are in a couple minutes. We'll finally get it together. I am used to dealing with a deadline. It's part of me. It's not a strain in my life to deal with a deadline. What becomes a problem in television are the mechanics. You know, a guest gets caught in traffic. We had that happen. We had a guest didn't show up because they had a fire in the Capitol building just as he was ready to get in a car to come out to the studio, and they blocked it off. He couldn't get out, and so we had to cancel the segment. And so you're sitting, you know, you got all kinds of fallbacks and this and that and the other thing. But what I had to learn, and I learned this after the heart attack, because I had no choice, I felt I had no choice, is don't get upset about things I'm not in charge of. Don't get upset about things I cannot control. I mean, I was interviewing Beryl Sprinkle, who is the president's chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors recently, and I had just asked him some deep, I'm sure, penetrating question about something very important about the economy, and suddenly, pop, this loud noise. And I knew what it was. A light had right above his head had popped. And I smelled, and I knew there was a fire up there. I knew if I looked up there, though, it would destroy the thing, because he would then look up there. So I never moved my eyes from his, and we just kept talking. And I smelt that fire, and I know that we finished the interview, and then we looked up, you know, and they rushed in and put the fire out and all of that. And I don't know when I told you that story, but...
I guess that's the kind of thing you have to do, though,
right.
Is focus on what you're doing and not worry a lot.
That's exactly right. And be confident that the people who do know what they're doing, that are working with you, know what they're doing. And you have to eventually trust people. That's the other part of it. It's very difficult to do in a journalistic situation, because you think, oh, well, I mean, is that really right? Are you sure? You know, how many times do you ask people that question? Are you sure the lines are up? Are you sure to San Francisco? Are you sure this? And eventually you quit asking those questions. Certainly they're up. You assume everything's going to work.
Okay, well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
My guest has been Jim Lehrer, and he's the co-anchor of the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour on public television. He's also a playwright and a novelist. His new novel has just been published. It's titled Kick the Can, and it's published by Putnam. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.